Hey folks, today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Online Counseling. If you need some help with your happiness or achieving your goals, BetterHelp is here for you. It can offer a crucial assist. These are licensed professional counselors. Get connected in under 24 hours, talk in a safe online environment, change counselors for free if necessary. This is a convenient, confidential, professional, affordable service. Whether you're dealing with depression, stress, anxiety, relationship issues, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBTQ matters, grief, self-esteem, whatever it is, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. And best of all, you get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/otherppl. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/otherppl. All right? Okay.
I once brought by one of the ends of the earth. I rode a horse from horse to change his water, and I gave no indication to anyone at all.
All right, everybody. How's it going out there? Welcome. Welcome to the Other People Show. My name is Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It is good to be with you. I have Jean Keong Frazier on the program today. Her debut novel is called Pizza Girl. It's available from Doubleday. It is the official July pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. The Nervous Breakdown Book Club is my online book club. The Nervous Breakdown is my online culture magazine. It has its own book club, is what I meant to say. Go to thenervousbreakdown.com if you're interested in joining the book club. What can I tell you about this conversation? I can tell you this. I was incredibly sleep deprived during this interview. This happens sometimes. I have children. My children sleep most of the time. When they don't sleep, I don't sleep. This was one of those times. You're going to hear that in just a moment. If I sound a little punchy, it's because I probably was running on like an hour and a half of sleep or something like that. So I should also add that Jean Keong Frazier and I share something in common. We are both pizza delivery drivers, not currently, but we have driven, and this is a special bond. You might not be aware of this, but people who drive, people who have driven, they share a bond, an immediate rapport. And it was just a delight to talk with Jean, meet her, catch her at this moment when she's just debuting this wonderful new novel. So here we go. Let's do it. This is my conversation with Jean Keong Frazier. Her novel, again, is called Pizza Girl. It's available from Doubleday, the official July pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. This is Jean Keong Frazier.
It's funny. I did not think it would be my first novel by any means. I'm a big basketball fan, and I always thought young, ambitious me wanted to write the great basketball novel of America, you know, because there's not a lot of high literary sports fiction. I loved those Matt Christopher books when I was a kid. I don't know if you ever read those pulpy books with titles like The Kid Who Only Hit Homers or The Guy with the Submarine Pitch. Anyway, but yeah, it just sort of seemed like, for lack of a better word, a really good vehicle to tell a story with, you know.
Basketball or pizza?
The pizza delivery. Yeah, pizza delivery. And so then just basically everything I was kind of thinking about, you know, like, young parenthood, sexual fluidity, Americanization, it all kind of found a way into this story, and I just started expanding it, and then I had a novel eventually.
So what was the factor that caused you to write this book instead of the basketball book?
God, that's a good question. I don't know exactly. It's like I think a lot about writing books at the times that we need them. The basketball idea was fun, and it definitely had some good lines and everything, but there wasn't a lot of emotional drive there, where with the pizza novel, I had just moved to New York City and I was bartending a lot. And I was thinking a lot about the unknowability of people, just like the weirdness of like meeting people and being your best version of yourself for a couple minutes at a time. There was this one couple that I really liked. And till one day I was working under the bar, I was crouching down cleaning, and I heard her ask him, "Where does your wife think you are right now?" And it just really hurt my heart a little bit. But it's also, it's like that kind of thing of like, well, I don't know them. Why should that hurt me?
Because they're like fictional characters for you. You need them to perform a certain role.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's just something weird about service jobs like that in general. It's like everyone kind of performing and kind of like we're being the people that we all need. You know, like everyone likes the friendly bartender. Everyone likes to joke around and have a quote unquote like fun moment with their pizza guy or girl, you know?
Well, I think for some people, too, you know, there's so much loneliness in our culture.
Yeah.
that the interactions we have with service industry professionals might be some, you know, they might be some of the only meaningful interactions we have at all.
Right.
And I should say too, because there is, I think, especially, and I'm sure you probably dealt with this, being a female pizza delivery person, that, you know, these jobs can become sexualized.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You might get people hitting on you. I mean, that even happened to me like once or twice, but, I can recall, because I was shy as a young single guy in my 20s, I would always like develop crushes on like waitresses and bartenders.
Just
because I was so bad at approaching people. I was just like, okay, well, this person I can like sort of talk to, you know, and like,
we call it a crushed-umer, a crushed-umer.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
Yeah.
I was a crushed-umer, and I hope that it wasn't creepy. I was just, you know, I think people just are awkward sometimes.
Totally. I remember this was at the last bar I was at. I was towards the end of my shift, and this guy came up to me and he said, I feel like we have a really good connection. I don't know. I was thinking maybe we should go on a date one of these days. And I felt so awful, but I was just like, and I didn't know how it was going to go too, because you never know how it's going to go when you turn someone down, especially a strange man you don't know. And I was like, I don't really feel that way about you. And he was really cool about it. He's like, I'm sorry about that. I hope I can still come in here. And I was like, yeah, of course. And that was that. And it was a completely nice interaction, you know? So that can happen sometimes too. It's just, again, furthering that point of like, it's so hard sometimes to feel like you can put yourself out there. It makes sense when it's someone you see all the time, you know, like I had become a figure to him almost.
Okay. So did that guy come back to the bar or come back?
He did. Yeah. It was completely normal. You know, he was just a normal guy. You know?
Wow. Okay. Well, that's like the most civil thing ever.
Yeah. It was very civil. That's the thing. I felt the hair on my neck prickle, because it's never, it can go much worse than that. But that was a really nice one. That was a really nice one.
Have you had situations where it's gone south?
More that it's like people can be like pushy, being like, no, just like come out with me once, or like, you know, have a drink with me just this one time. I've been lucky though. I've been able to get out of it. I definitely know that there are situations for people that don't go well, but I've been lucky in that way.
So I want to talk to you as well about some advice that you, I think you were in, doing an interview that I was reading, and the interviewer was asking you for your thoughts on like advice you would give to a young writer. And I'm paraphrasing, but I remember you saying basically that your advice was to young writers was to just not give a fuck, or to give like less fucks as you're writing. And like I think to somebody maybe listening at first blush, that might sound a little crude or something, but I gotta say, when I was reading it, it totally resonated with me. And it might be because I'm in the midst of writing a book that I give like a lot of fucks about. And I think that can actually, that can like muck up the works. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think there's like real wisdom in what you were saying is what I'm trying to tell you.
Right.
So can you elaborate on don't give a fuck?
Oh, it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's like I try to, like, I give that advice, and I'm like you. It's really hard for me to take it sometimes, because it's like, you know, everything I write, I'm always thinking, I'm like, oh man, I hope this isn't dumb. Oh man, I hope someone reads this and feels this and like believes it. You know, like they believe that I believed it, and everything too. So it's like my advice was almost just like, don't worry so much if you're giving a lot of fucks, because ultimately it's coming from a really good place. You're caring about your words and their effect on other people. But it will be better for your sanity for sure if you can just sort of like go with the flow and just kind of focus on yourself. Like I actually don't share my writing with anyone until I'm done. I don't really do writing groups and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't either. Like do you have like first readers or anything like that before you go to like your agent or your editor?
I'm trying to do that this time around. I'm trying to do a lot of things different this time around just to like feel better and everything. But no, funny enough with Pizza Girl, I wrote it all. I finished it at like 3 a.m. one day, and I was so excited. I like poured myself a little glass of this Johnny Walker Blue. I was so tired though, I fell asleep. And when I woke up the next morning, there was like a dead fly in the glass, and I was like, ooh, bad omen.
That's a good omen.
You think it's a good omen? Well, it ended up working out, because just later that day, I just looked up some agents that repped people I liked and sent out a few emails. And the first one actually ended up being my agent.
Well, see, there you go. It was a good omen.
Yeah, apparently.
I feel like when anything like that happens, like it's just best to just default to it's a good omen. Like, you know.
Yeah, make it positive and whatnot. I think it's sort of that thing too. It's like looking back, I'm like, that is insane that I did that. But there's like a part of me, and it's sort of tied to the like don't give a fuck mentality of like, I talk myself out of things all the time. And maybe if I had talked myself out of that, I obviously would have still written Pizza Girl, and I have to believe it still would have been published, but there was something maybe about the urgency of it that would have been lost if I tinkered with it too much.
How long did it take you to write?
The actual writing, a little less than a year, but I had had the idea. I had the first line. Her name was Jenny Hauser, and every Wednesday I put pickles on her pizza for about 2.5, 3 years.
Interesting. That's the first thing that came to you, was that line?
Yeah, yeah, because I was thinking, I'm a big line gal, and I love a good banger of a first line. And I was just thinking, I was like, okay, what's the story about? I was like, it's definitely a delivery driver falling into obsession with a customer. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to basically say it from the beginning. Her name, and then something like kind of like weird, a little sexual, definitely intriguing, you know, like pickles on her pizza. What the hell is that? So I just wanted a grabby line, and it ended up staying the first line.
Have you ever had pickles on a pizza?
I have, actually. I in South Dakota. I have family in North Dakota and Minnesota area, and I was just driving a little bit, and I stopped at this hole in the wall, and they had it on the menu, and it was actually pretty good. I was surprised. I don't know why more places don't do it.
Okay, so a couple things. First of all, like, I don't think you should ever put fruit on a pizza. I'm not a pineapple person.
I am very anti-pineapple. I had an ex that did pineapple pizza exclusively, and I'm convinced that's why ultimately we were never going to work.
Yeah, no, it's just it's morally wrong. But I think that you can put almost anything on a pizza. Like, the basic technology of pizza, like dough, tomato sauce,
yes,
cheese, it's hard to fuck it up. You know, just about anything on top of that is going to be fine.
Yeah, the funniest is that I've been getting so many questions, especially from New Yorkers, like, tell me your favorite place to get a slice, this, that. And I was like, I am trash. I would order Domino's sometimes in the city, or, you know, I love Little Caesars. All pizza is pretty good to me.
I wish I could eat dairy, but I...
Are you lactose intolerant?
You know, I wasn't until I became a vegan, and then it screwed up my whole system.
Oh.
So, but I will still to this day, I'll just take a piece of pizza and just rip the cheese off. So, I mean, I'm not that like elegant about any of it, but I like Tombstone pizza, like the frozen pizza that you, I grew up on that. I think that stuff's good too, right? Or DiGiorno.
Oh, love that guy.
he's a hero. So where are you from? You said, you just mentioned, what is it? South Dakota and Minnesota?
Yeah, split time between there and the LA area.
Where in Minnesota?
Funny enough, Pelican Rapids. It's an hour out of Fargo, North Dakota. Yeah, so it's like right on the border there.
My wife is from Minneapolis.
Oh, very cool.
I've spent some time up there. But then you came out to LA.
Yes. Yeah, I currently live in like the Chinatown Echo Park area.
Oh, you do? Okay, so you left New York.
I did. I miss it, but it felt like time to come back and sort of like, I've never lived in LA as like a normal adult, if that makes sense. And I just kind of wanted to see how that would look.
How's it looking?
Not too bad. I mean, I know this is such a strange, uncertain time, but I've been trying to be positive about it. And, you know, I mean, I'm luckier than most in that I have my health and all my loved ones have their health. So, yeah, I've been trying to just be as productive and unproductive as I want to, if that makes sense. Like, you need to have days, I think, where you don't.
I've probably been more productive during COVID than I
would. Oh, yeah?
I was always pretty productive. I've got a lot going on, but I feel like maybe it focused me. Or I'm just like, I think I'm kind of not a shut-in. Like, I don't feel lonely because I have a family and... Mm. There's always chaos in my house. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I know what you mean.
So it's not like I'm in some sort of like tower, like Montaigne or something. Like it's, I'm like 10 feet from chaos at all times. But I feel like maybe COVID made the way that I tend to operate more socially acceptable somehow, because it's kind of enforced it on everybody.
Yeah.
And then I think once it happened, I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to lock in because this is going on and nothing's going to change it anytime soon. You know, it just seems like we're locked into this until we get crazy pants out of the White House.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been up and down. I'm either also a really good friend during this time or like a really bad friend, you know, because it's like I feel like because I've had so much extra time and you can't really go out or do things like that, you're spending more time on the phone or you're Zooming. And it's caused me and a lot of friends that I wouldn't normally talk to like reconnect, which has been really nice, you know, and in a really deep level, I think, too.
Yeah, I think phone calls made a bit of a comeback during the pandemic, or have made a bit of a comeback during the pandemic.
Well, because you get Zoom burnout. Like, there's something different. Like, you're staring at a screen and you're talking, but you're not getting the same pleasure of sitting across from someone. Like, it is nice to see a friend and see their face, but sometimes it's like after just a long day, it's sort of nice to just be able to walk around and not look at anything in particular and just talk to someone on the phone. Like, I'm really enjoying talking to you right now. You know, this is nice.
Yeah. Are you walking around?
I am not. I was nervous if I walked around, my voice would get shaky, this, that. Does my voice sound nervous? I'm never sure how my voice sounds.
No. Is this your nervous voice?
I do feel nervous a little bit.
I feel like my voice gets higher when I'm like anxious in some way. Mm. And then maybe it gets like extra low when I'm self-conscious.
Mm.
Like I try to be like more... And then hopefully it's somewhere,
somewhere in the middle.
Land somewhere in the middle between anxiety and like, you know, painful self-awareness.
No, your podcast voice is good. I sometimes joke that I use your podcast to help me fall asleep at night because it's like I get some good information, but also it's always very soothing, good level. And so I can go to sleep well, too.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So when did you, like, tell me, like, divide it up for me. You live in the upper Midwest from when to when, and then when do you get out to LA for your, I guess, your high school years?
Yeah, around that time, and I went to college out here, too, and then I moved to New York to really pursue writing actively, you know. I was a business major at the beginning of college, but it made me really unhappy, and I was really honestly thinking about dropping out just because I didn't really see the point, you know, and that I think my lack of ambition made me feel bad, if that makes sense, because it's like with, I don't know, I was basically having what I understand now is like millennial burnout, you know, but at the time it just felt like I was just this huge loser that couldn't keep up with all my like beautiful, attractive, smart classmates. But it really was just that I was studying stuff that I didn't have any interest in. Like, I just wanted to be a business major because I wanted to make money, you know, have a pair of Jordans that matched every one of my outfits, you know, pool, shit like that. But yeah, I changed to English and it really felt like, it sounds so cheesy, like a dorky thing, but it really felt like I found my people and like I was excited to go to class. That didn't happen often for me.
Okay, so let me, just because I never majored in business, what is it like? What is it like to major in business? What do you do? You have like sit around like reading case studies or?
I will say I ditched a lot. I really wasn't very involved. The thing I remember though, the one fun thing I remember, we had this management class and we would always do fun exercises, or he did a funny one once. I particularly remember this one where the professor tapped a beat out and then he had all of us like write down what we thought the beat was. And of course, no one got it. And it was like the Mario song. And he just paralleled it as this fun example of like, see, even though you think something clear, you should be, you know, it's not always clear to everyone else. I was like, yeah. So there was a lot of cute stuff like that. But yeah, I didn't love my classmates. The material didn't really stick for me. I don't know.
And you said you felt bad about your lack of ambition.
Yeah, it felt like I wanted to be ambitious, if that makes sense.
I can totally relate to that. I've talked about this, I think, on the show more than once. It's like this complicated relationship that I have with the word ambition and what it stands for, and how And you know, you're a sports fan, so we can use that paradigm to sort of drill down into it. But like, I think of whenever they talk about quarterbacks in professional football,
right?
If you watch enough sports media, there's a trope where like the sportscasters will lionize the competitive mania of the great quarterback, and they will talk about how, like, this grown man, when he like loses a game of Monopoly or like ping pong, like throws a temper tantrum and like whips a paddle and like takes a chunk out of the drywall and, you know, like storms out of the room. And like, this is considered a positive story meant to underscore the competitive fire. And to me, it sounds like mental illness.
I know. It sounds just like, wow, you need to talk to someone. You need to figure out a way to deal with that.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's like, I kind of like, if we're staying on the sports thing, I remember it's like, I played basketball competitively for so long and it just made me feel almost ill towards the end of it, because it's like, it wasn't even that I wanted to win. It wasn't even that I was enjoying winning, but I like the losing just made me feel terrible, you know? And I just hated that I was putting myself in this position that I felt like I had to go, go, go. And the best I would feel if I won was just this sort of like, oh, thank God it's over. You know, and it's weird to feel that way just in your life.
You know what made me feel worse? Mm. When I, like, a couple times, I was a soccer player when I was younger.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
When we would tie.
Mm. God.
And I'd be like, well, what the fuck was the point of that? Like, at least let me know how to feel. Like, I just had I hated being in that, like, I either wanted to feel terrible about myself for losing, or I wanted to feel like that, like, you know, that caffeine high or the sugar high of winning. And
totally.
When you tie, like, and as a sports fan, I'm the same way. Like, there should be no ties. Like, in competitive soccer, there you have a shootout and you decide a winner. You don't have a tie at the end of regulation. I think that's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what's the so confusing thing about ambition. Like, at least in sports, outside of a tie, there's like very clear ways of how everything's going to go. With like ambition, you know, you should be feeling it, but if you don't have a concrete goal, it just kind of turns into this uneasy chest feeling that you're kind of carrying around.
Yeah, I just remember in college, that's when it, I mean, I was never a great athlete. Like, I didn't I didn't like thrive as an athlete in high school. I played like some tennis. I was the kicker on the football team for like a year. I was no good.
Nice.
Either. I missed the only field goal I ever tried. but I, you know, I think if I were not, I was at this big, huge public high school, you know, with like 700 people in my graduating class. So there's like 12 spots on the basketball team. Like, you know, you have to be really good to make the team. I was somewhere in the middle, so I wasn't going to make it, but I wasn't like a bad athlete. And I just remember, like, maybe it's no accident. Like, I went off to college and, you know, I was like smoking pot. I was like, why do people care about this so much? Like, I got, you know, I don't know if pot had, you know, if it was that much of a direct correlation, but, you know, just that time in my life where I was reevaluating things and I was like, this is silliness. Like, what is going on with the way that we relate to one another through this like competitive lens? And it still bothers me.
Yeah. I think it's especially complicated for my generation because like we have had like, this fucks with me all the time when Facebook reminds me that I've had it for like 14 years or whatever. Or they've been like, remember this from 11 years ago? And you're like, no, please don't remind me.
Yeah.
But like kind of this like weirdness of like, we've always had so many ways to compare ourselves to our peers, you know? Like,
may I ask how old you are?
Oh, I'm 27. I just turned 27 in April.
God, you're such a baby, and you've got got a novel out on a major imprint. Look at you.
God, it's definitely a lot. I feel very lucky.
Yeah,
truly,
it's fantastic. And so, so you're at the young end of the millennial range, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
So you're almost what comes after millennials? Gen Z?
It's Gen Z, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, because it's funny, my brother is 6 years younger than me, so we're firmly in separate generations. And we talk a lot about like sort of how different that looks and how we're different and all that stuff.
Does he have it worse than you? Or like, who's like, I feel like that's the competition.
I don't know. I definitely, what they talk about is that like, maybe like simply put, like millennials were sold the dream and they believed it. Gen Z's never believed it. is kind of the idea. That being said, though, it's like the dream is bullshit. And I remember I was hanging out with I used to babysit my brother sometimes, and I still hang with him and his friends. And I remember I was home from college and I was hanging with them, and I was just shook that these high school kids were so vulnerable and open and talking about things that, like, me and my friends weren't talking about in high school. I don't know. I like young people.
Yeah, I do too. I think I just think in general, in any generation, like, you get to people before they're spoiled.
Yeah.
And I don't mean spoiled meaning they get everything they want. I just mean, like,
totally.
Before, like, life, like, just, wrings the joy out of them and scrambles their brains. You know, there's something kind of great and heartbreaking and beautiful about that little window of time in life when you have everything in front of you. And, you know, you I think you can have maybe more confidence or what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you're less wobbly about having, like, really strong ideals because you haven't had them challenged or stomped on. Maybe.
I don't know. It's God, I go back and forth on it. It's like, I was simultaneously more afraid and less afraid to fail too. You know, I felt bouncier somehow. You know what I mean? It's kind of that feeling of, like, the Looney Tunes anvil is going to hit me, but I'm going to pop right back up after, you know? But yeah, I mean, that's why it felt so key for me to write Pizza Girl before that experience, like that age and that feeling was too far in my rearview window. You know, I already feel like I've forgotten so much and I haven't even had my 10-year reunion.
Well, and I it's different for people who grew up online in like, that's just your world and you never knew any different. And I think having social media just be reality, that's the difference. I'm 44. So that means I'm significantly, I don't know, am I two generations removed from you? Who knows?
But we have a similar spirit, Brad. I can feel it.
Well, no, here's the thing. This is the point that I'm getting at is that my generation, when we graduated college, everybody went out. It was the first .com bubble. And like all these people in my graduating class went out and like got these jobs in tech and like made like, you know, a bazillion dollars. None of that ever touched me. I never came. I never came within like sniffing. I wasn't interested in any of that. But I did not ride that wave. I had no such luck. I didn't have any instincts to like. So I kind of feel like maybe I find it easier to relate to a generation that's sort of been on the periphery of, you know, on the outside looking in when it comes to the dream ride or that wave or whatever.
Right.
Like that to me is much more relatable. And frankly, I think it's always been the norm. I think maybe there was a stronger, like a broader base of belief in the possibility of it in previous generations. And maybe people have gotten a little wiser or more cynical.
Right.
But statistically speaking, in terms of the dream being realized, I don't think it was ever that. Well, you know what? I shouldn't say that because I think, like, you know, my parents' generation, the baby boomers, you could have a single income family and own a home and send your kids to college. And you could own a home and send your kids to college while working like a union factory job for like a brief period of a couple decades after World War II. Like that's
my mom went to the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And like, I think it was like a grand a semester or something, you know what I mean? Something insanely low. And she thought that was expensive.
Right.
At the time, you know,
that's right. My parents went to Louisiana State University and
my mom
came from a family of 9 kids and they all went to school, you know, and it's because it was cheap.
Yeah. I mean, my mom was the first, I mean, she has siblings, but they were all the first generation to go to college and do that. She has a funny story actually of her job. She worked while she was in college where she was the first one. She was fired from it. It was a diner. And she had just immigrated and she just was so fascinated and so like awestruck that they had so much ice available because she grew up in a village that was like a rarity. So she was putting ice in everything, like putting ice in orange juice and in glasses of milk and just sort of messing up a lot of orders like that. So eventually her boss just let her go. He's like, I don't think you're going to last here.
where did she immigrate from?
She immigrated from a small village outside of Seoul, Korea.
Oh, okay. And what prompted that? Just wanting to come over and
well, that's one of the only true parts of my novel, or like really based off of my life, is like the story about how the mother came from Korea because her dad's uncle had a business in Champaign-Urbana and was like, this is the promised land. You've got to come to America. You got to come to this town. And so they, as a family, her and all my siblings immigrated there when she was about 17.
Oh, wow. And that was easy to do?
Yeah, but not as hard as it is today, for sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. When the doors are wide open.
Yeah. She has a funny story just about how she was baffled how cheap bananas were. That was also a delicacy for her.
I read, it was like, I don't know, it's one of those stories that was going around the internet that like bananas were done. Like they were dying out.
Done. Not...
Maybe, I don't know. I felt like I read some story like they were going to go extinct because of climate change or something.
Well, I mean, as a personal taste level, that doesn't make me too sad. I've never been a banana fiend, you know?
But have you put them on a pizza is the question.
Oh, shit. I might have to try that one. The worst dish I ever made, this was when I was definitely delivering pizzas and stoned. I made a hot dog salad with maple syrup dressing.
Damn.
It was as bad as it sounds. It was not good.
Sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, man.
What is a hot dog salad? Like, do you have greens or is it just like...
Just like iceberg lettuce with hot dog chunks.
Like that's the Midwestern girl in you right
there.
Yeah. The iceberg lettuce.
Yeah.
Like just the completely nutritionally void lettuce that like allows you to like act like you're having a leafy green.
Yeah, it just makes you feel better.
Like I feel like too, like taco salads in the Midwest with the tortilla.
God,
the tortilla.
Gross. Yeah. Can't do it.
And then like what's the one with cottage cheese? That's the one that really grosses me out the most, where it's like, oh God, I forget what the name of it is.
I'm thinking of like ambrosia or what are you thinking of?
No, I'm thinking of like a salad that involves like a grapefruit and, or maybe, I don't know.
Either way, I can't do cottage cheese either. Oof.
No, me neither. Why would anyone have even considered?
I consider myself very uneasy with food too. Like I still make fried bologna sandwiches. Love that shit.
Really?
Yes. I'll send you a pic. It's actually, it's a good low budget meal.
Is it actually, you're frying bologna?
Yes.
You have a fryer?
No, I mean, well, not fry. I mean, you just sort of pan sear it. They just call it fried bologna sandwiches.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what I didn't know if you were like actually dipping it into a vat of oil.
That would actually probably be pretty good. I should try that.
Yeah. Well, I think that there you go again, though. Like we talked about how anything can be good on pizza. I think just about anything can be good if you fry it.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
But I think, you know, to have a home fryer is a level of commitment that one has to.
Yeah, there's other things. The thing I want most in my next apartment, me and my roommate were talking about this. I want that fridge where you can, like, it has an ice dispenser on the outside. You know what I'm talking about? Like, I can put my cup, like, it has a little thing where you can just ice will come out of, like, if you hit a lever.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I'm like, I'm thinking about, like, the water quality in Los Angeles, though. I always get worried about it.
Fair enough.
We have two different water filters at my house. I'm like, I don't want to drink any weird chemicals. I've got enough chemicals I'm breathing probably living here.
Yeah.
So your mom comes over from Korea. She's in Champaign-Urbana. She's first generation and she's going to college. And then what about your dad? Where's he from?
He's from Pelican Rapids, Minnesota. He was a doctoral candidate at University of Illinois and they met there.
Oh, okay. So do you have a writerly parent?
I don't. It's so fun. You know, it's like my dad doesn't read anything but his sci-fi paperbacks, which I, you know, of course, as an act of rebellion as a kid, I pretended I can't stand. And I'm now finding my way to. I'm like, oh, sci-fi is really cool.
Yeah.
But my mom is the artistic one. She is a fashion designer and was always encouraging me to read as a kid. Books were like the only thing I could ask her for that she would buy me without question. You know,
yeah, that's our policy with our kids.
Yeah. I think it's a good one. I'm gonna. If I have kids, I'm doing that
too.
Yeah,
you can always have a book, and
yeah,
it's worked out so far. They don't ask for too many, you know. I guess it could backfire. They really go hog wild, but they can't read that fast.
Right.
But what kind of fashion does your mom do? Is she designing like dresses and stuff? And
yeah, she does. It's basically like they call it junior fashion. So for like teenagers, a little bit older, a lot of young adult stuff. My mom is very fashionable and I feel so bad because I know she had me, her first and only daughter, and was probably so excited for me to take you know, follow her footsteps. And I just, I'm so uninterested in it. I like colors, but
you're like, Mom, I just want to wear some Jordans and some sweats.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? The thing is, though, I love my mom and I give her so much credit because it's like, I know she was expecting a typical quote unquote girly girl. And she got me, but she also did come to every single one of my basketball games. She'd always get off work. She'd always go over there. And of course, after watching me for even like a week, she started having opinions on everything. She's like, "Hey, Jean, I think your shot needs a little more oomph." And I was like, "Oh, is that the term, Mom?"
Well, she sounds like a good parent.
Yeah. No, I'm very lucky.
And you have siblings? Did you say something?
I have a little brother. His name's Ryan. I named him after a park I liked. He's a good kid.
Okay. So, and where in LA did you guys move to, and what prompted it, like when you guys left the Midwest?
We grew up in the South Bay Area. I went to Palos Verdes Peninsula High School, nice high school, good area. And yeah, and then I ended up going to SC.
Dude, Palos Verdes is so beautiful.
I don't like the vibe of it, but it's gorgeous.
My God. I've spent maybe the total of 2 hours, 3 hours, you know, because I went on a, during pandemic. I have been trying to think of things to do with my kids that were safe. So we would just like put them in the car and like drive to places in Los Angeles that we haven't been before.
Yeah, that's a good one to drive through.
Yeah, we drove on along the Coast Road, you know, whatever it's called, Palos Verdes.
PCH or Palos Verdes Drive, something like that.
I think that's what, I think up there it's called Palos Verdes Drive. And it was just like shockingly beautiful. I couldn't believe I hadn't been there before. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a nice place to grow up. I mean, was it culture shock coming from, you know, South Dakota and suddenly being?
Definitely. I was younger, so it would have been worse if we waited longer, I think. So I feel lucky in that way, you know. But I love going home to the Minnesota, North Dakota area now.
In the summer, it's the best.
Oh, it's gorgeous out there. I love a lake. I could fish all day. I have a lot of old man habits in that way.
You like to fish?
I do.
Do you fish now in like California?
No, I tried once and it just depressed me so much. It was somewhere in Irvine area. It was like a man-made lake.
Oh, God.
And I watched them as we were going out on the boat, me and my best friend. We watched a truck dump a bunch of fish into the lake and it just made me so sad.
Yeah, no, it's not good.
God. Yeah.
But I'm sure you could get, if you go in, you went up into like towards Yosemite or something, you could find some good fishing.
For sure.
So you're growing up in Palos Verdes and then you said you went to USC?
Yeah.
And so, okay, I can see this now. You're like towing the waters of business school. Like it's business school sounds nightmarish enough just on the face of it. But then business school at USC sounds like really creepy.
It was a lot. I think it was just tough because it's like, I mean, you know, and I go over it in my book a little bit too, just sort of like you have a parent and parents that work so hard for you and you want to do right by them too. I wanted to just have a nice, normal life. Like, go to a good college and get a good job. And, you know, but if you keep thinking about it, you're like, when does it stop? When do I have to stop working so hard or trying to shove this round, like the circle into what is it? The square peg into the circular, whatever. Just, I don't know, just trying to make something work that isn't for me.
I think what we're coming back to right here, Jean, is just to give less of a fuck.
Exactly.
That's the recurring theme of this episode is just everybody needs to take it down a notch and just care a little bit less. But I understand.
Or pick the right things to care about for sure.
That's what we mean. But I think that I think that's like admirable to feel a sense of responsibility, especially at that age, to one's parents. Like I don't think I necessarily had enough of that. I think I didn't fully appreciate the level of good fortune or just like good parenting that I had, you know, like it was just, you know, I just get to go to college. Everybody goes to college, you know, like it's kind of like, you know, sadly it was kind of like that, but, you know, I went off and dicked around. I sort of wish I would have done a gap year. I kind of needed a break, you know.
I actually really, I wish they would require that, frankly, you know. Well, I really do.
I think there's a lot of logic in the idea that after like what, you know, 15 years of consecutive schooling where you're up at 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and you're in back-to-back classes for 8 hours. After 15 years of that, like memorization and test taking and Scantron forms or whatever it was, Like, why would you not want a break? Like, I think it's normal to be tired at that point. Like, I don't.
Well, that's why people have like quarter life crises right after they graduate from college. You know, they've been in a very structured way of living for most of their lives. And then they're being like, okay, you're done. Do whatever you want now.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's like, okay. Yeah. And what is that supposed to be? Unless you're a business school major who like had, you know, has. Like, there is a part of me, I think, that as much as I like to rag on business school, like, obviously there's nothing inherently wrong with it.
No.
And you can do, you can be a, you know, what's the word? An ethical business person. I mean, that's.
You had to search for that term.
Yeah.
It's not very common.
I have a hard. What's that word? Ethical. Oh, yeah. Ethical. But no, you know, like, there's a lot of different ways to do life, and you got to find what works for you. But I think part of it is that there are people who are unethical, which kind of makes you cynical. But then there's also a part of me, if I'm being honest, that is a little bit envious of people who are the round pegs.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Like they go out and they're like, oh yeah, this is great. I can't wait to be like an entrepreneur. Like, I can't wait to climb the corporate ladder. And you know, I want to be, and it's like, oh shit. Well, that's really lucky to have such a nice, easy transition.
Yeah, sometimes it's like, you know, and I don't mean to sound like a douche at all, but you just meet someone that has like very simple, clear cut goals like that. And that always just made me so jealous. Like, people who know exactly what they want. They're like, yeah, well, I'm going to graduate and then I'm going to work there and I'll marry my boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, whoever, you know, and that's that. And I'm like, wow.
Who are these monsters?
Luckily, I don't know many of them.
Yeah,
so.
Right. I think there's the cynical part of me that's sort of eye rolling and just being like, you are hanging on so tight, you control freak, you need to know it. Like, I don't even trust it. And yet there are probably some people who do have their shit that together.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I go back and forth. I'm like, man, are you just really so much better at holding it together than me? Or is this truly everything that you want? Either way, I don't know.
I don't know. The part of me is just really resisting the idea that anybody could possibly know, but maybe they do. Maybe they do.
Yeah.
I don't want to presume on behalf of somebody else, but I think,
hey, whatever gets you through your days, you know?
Yeah. And I think, yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, on the flip side, if we're going to try to find like the silver lining in being like wired for a writerly existence, which is to say, it's a hard life. Like, I don't think, I mean, I guess you can get a ride. Occasionally there's like the ride where a book sells a bajillion copies or, you know, you become like Stephen King or something. And
yeah, my mom will send me things like, Stephen King buys this $2 million home. And I was like, Mom, you have not read my writing. That's never going to happen to me.
And like it gets like 15,000 words a day or something. Yeah. You know, it's just like, oh my God, you know, like, but I think that, you know, the positive side of having this kind of wiring where you're quirky or something, for lack of a better word. And I don't like that word, but that, like, I feel like that gets tagged on people where it's like, we don't quite know where you fit, but you're interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you a cue word.
Yeah. We're not seeing a really high upside for you, but we like you. So you're quirky. But I feel like, you know, if you have the endurance, you know, and a little bit of luck, I guess, goes into being able to have the endurance. But if you have the endurance and you stick it out and you're able to carve out a career, I think that career is like the awesomest, even if it's not like the most lucrative or traditionally successful. Like, that's sort of the dream, I think, for me, is to try to find a way to, you know, to carve something out on my own terms that is an expression of my highest values and is also an expression of the quirk.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I remember this happened like a year ago. I had sold my book, and like the month after I sold my book, I was just such a wreck. Like, I just knew it was that thing of, I was like, I should be so happy. And that somehow made me so sad. I was just so nervous that I just had made a huge mistake and that everyone was going to hate my book. And I just wasn't sleeping well. I was waking up sweaty all the time. And my friend was working over at Anonymous Content. And she said, she's like, dude, my friend read your book and like loves it. I was like, oh, wow, that's super nice. She's like, you should come out for drinks with us. So I went out with her and a bunch of assistants. And we eventually started talking about my book. And it opened up a conversation. People were talking about like their early, like just sexuality, and sort of the way they fell into like their own and how they're still considering it. And it was just kind of that moment where I had to go to the bathroom. I got a little worked up. It just was like so moving. I was like, oh my God, my book started like this really cool conversation.
That's right. That's right.
You know?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it's great that you had that moment and that you recognized it when it was happening.
Totally. It was like just a really simple, lovely reminder. You're like, oh yeah, that's why I like to do this. Because it's easier just like, man, especially when you're not a Stephen King who's writing 15,000 words a day. You're just like, why do I like beat myself up over this? Why do I work so hard on this?
Well, yeah. And I sort of live with this show at the intersection of writing and publishing and publicity, you know? So
right,
I'm at this weird, sad street corner.
Great mental image.
Yeah, just me just hanging out here with a microphone.
You with your thumb out.
Well, and just people coming to me, you know, in various states of either elation or duress or, you know, I think people sometimes spend obviously years on a book and then they get to this this moment where it's out and they're doing the rounds and then they're looking at sales and just going, oh my God, like I spent 6 years of my life on this thing and it sold like, you know, 400 copies. Am I doomed? Did I just waste my life? You know, this kind of thing.
Right.
But right. I think a couple of things. First of all, a lot of times books have a slow burn. You never know what's going to happen, you know?
I feel like I sometimes read a book. I'm like, whoa, why didn't I read this book 5 years ago when it came out?
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's incredible.
I mean, there's so many books. It's impossible for people to keep up. And I think that like the sales number is never an accurate reflection of the quality of the work. It doesn't have any real,
I agree.
I mean, sometimes it has a correlation, but it's not like some sort of rule.
Yeah.
And then I think too of a line from a Steve Almond, who's like really great. He's just great on lines, but he's great about craft and stuff like that. But I think it might be from his Stoner book, but he's talking about, I'm talking about William Stoner, the novel Stoner, but he's, I like where your head went as soon as I said Stoner. But he's talking about how it's very easy as a writer to make the mistake of thinking that you're writing your book so that the world will know who you are, when the real role of the writer is to help the reader know who he or she is.
That's a beautiful, simple way to put it. Really.
Yeah. And I think it's reflected in the story that you were telling, where you're sitting at that table and all these people are sort of finding themselves in, like they're finding themselves reflected in your work, and they're finding not only that reflection, but they're finding some language for the reflection that they didn't previously have. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, totally. I mean, the best texts I've gotten and messages and phone calls I've had since people have read my book are when they tell me like where they read my book or the experience they had reading my book. I had a funny one. My friend texted me. This girl never reads. Mayuri, love you, girl. She texted me, started your book on the toilet. Perfect place.
Okay.
You know, and it's just like funny and sweet, though, to think about, like, I don't know, just me existing in her day. I had another friend who read my book on the beach, you know, or like someone was in a mountain retreat. It's simple stuff like that.
No, I always, in fact, for anybody listening to this podcast, please either tweet at OtherPPL or email me letters@otherppl.com take a picture of where you are when you're listening to this episode and then send it to me. I used to ask.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I used to ask people, like, why is it that the location of consumption is so interesting?
I don't know. That is such a funny question. I mean, I did this interview the other day where they asked me what my favorite library was, and it's not necessarily my favorite library, but like the Los Angeles Central Library, I have so many memories all through the years of 18 to 23 of just making that same bike down there, sitting like in the same place I'd usually sit and just reading. Like, I really think I've read like maybe half of the books in my life in that library, you know?
I find that story, not necessarily that it took place in a library, though it's a great place.
Yeah.
It's a great place for it to happen, but
yeah.
The story of a very intense, concentrated period of reading in early adulthood is often a part of a writer's bio.
Yeah, and it's a good way to put it.
I mean, it's not that you ever stop reading, but you might not have the same luxury of time that you had when you were in college or something, or
Very true.
You know, I did a huge amount of reading in my early 20s when I was like living at home after college, and I was just I was like floundering and didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then I was like, actually, this is perfect. Like, I like living at home because I can just like read, and then like, you know, I didn't have to, it kind of took some of the pressure off, you know, and it was, it was awesome. So, but I feel like you need that. You have to have some kind of like incubation period where you're getting tons of input in order for you to be able to kind of like process your influences and you know, create your own voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about the relationship, like the main relationship of your book between Pizza Girl and, now my brain is it Jenny? It's Jenny.
It is Jenny. Yeah. It is Jenny.
Jenny Hauser, the one.
I'm already forgetting too.
Yeah. No, I'm like, I was going to say Jane, but Jane is the Pizza Girl, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So like we have Jane, but I always call her just Pizza Girl, which I think.
I call her Pizza Girl too, actually.
Yeah. It's way more fun to call her Pizza Girl. So Pizza Girl.
Like a superhero.
Yeah, exactly. So Pizza Girl and Jenny have like a pretty like big age disparity.
Right.
But I found that their relationship was really touching. Mm. I don't know. I think like, I think about the way that females relate to each other, like independent of like amorous feelings, but just friendship, just the way that like women relate to one another. The older I get, the more envious I am of it. I know that it can sometimes be intense though too. Like sometimes it can go kind of batty in ways that maybe guy friendships don't, but guy friendships are so fucking dumb most of the time. I don't know. I you can find some good ones. I'm not saying you can't find good guy friendships, like I'm always the guy. I prefer to hang out with women. I think in general. I think it's more interesting to talk to women than it is to men, generally speaking.
Right.
But
yeah, I mean, I've been happy to see the change, like a new manliness sort of sprouting up in men. Like, I mean, you're a very sensitive, cool guy to talk to. You know what I mean? And that I feel like just sometimes it's like guys haven't been given permission to be as open as women have necessarily, you know, not to say it's easy to be a woman by any standards, but at least emotionally, you know, maybe at early adolescence.
I see it through the lens of parenthood.
The
way that moms relate to one another versus the way that dads relate to one another is really striking. and you know, I say this like not as a criticism of, this is a criticism of me. Like I'm probably like the prime offender, like antisocial dad who's not good at like, I'm not going to be the guy to like organize poker night. I'm just not going to do it. You know,
right.
Like, I don't even know how to play poker, but, you know,
I can teach you one of these days.
Yeah. Maybe we can go fishing together. You and me.
Oh, perfect. Go down we'll do a bunch of old man things.
Yeah. We'll go down to the LA River and we'll try to pull out some, whatever.
Catch a boot.
Yeah. Right. Catch something. Yeah. But yeah, no, I feel like maybe when I, you know, when it comes to parenthood, that's where it's become like most striking to me. The way in which the moms seem to be so industrious and warm-hearted about building community and supporting one another. Mm. And I envy it.
Mm.
And, you know, this is kind of connected, I think, to Pizza Girl and Jenny because Pizza Girl is pregnant. She's like, 11 weeks pregnant. And then Jenny is like, 20 years older than she is and a mom and sort of at an advanced like a more advanced phase of womanhood and motherhood and all this kind of stuff. And, and yet they have this bond that to me is totally understandable and relatable in a way that doesn't get talked about often enough in a reasonably benign context. Like usually, and maybe this is a gendered thing too, but like usually when there's like a guy my age who's friends with somebody who's younger, it's like, ooh, who's the creeper, you know? But I find I have a lot of relationships with people, like friendships with people in their 20s, like a handful. And I totally enjoy it. Like I love the perspective of youth. Like I think there's a part of me that's going to always want to be friends with people who are significantly younger than I am because I have some sort of almost superstitious faith in youth, kind of like tied to what we were talking about earlier, how like, you know, the unspoiled vantage of youth, even though it lacks the wisdom of the quote unquote wisdom of experience. I tend to trust like the kids more than I trust like all the adults who've had time to like become CEOs and senators and stuff. Like, you know, people, when they get to that point, I think it's all lost.
I hear you. Yeah, I mean, with their relationship too, it's just like, it's like that thing. It's also, there's so much complicated feelings tied up in it too. It's like, it's not completely unsexual, but there is this sort of mothering going on, but there's also just pure friendship. And they're both like kind of called to the void, if that makes sense too, you know, like agents of chaos.
Well, and I think like, I mean, I don't know. I think you can be just be friends with somebody, but if you're really close with somebody, if like you feel a strong connection with anybody, isn't there always some element of sexual?
I think so.
Right. I mean, like, let's be real about it. Like, even if you're like, you can be happily coupled, but if you're friends with like, if I'm friends with some guy, well, actually, you know what? I don't want to screw my friend, but I mean,
but you can feel like, I think that's the, like the thing. It's like, there were so many complicated feelings that you feel in a really sort of intense, deep friendship, you know, and it's hard to put a name on them all the time.
That's right. Know? That's right. It's like, there are like unnameable things that are like, sort of like,
I view them as like just sort of tender, sort of, I guess, squishy, for lack of a better word, feelings. Like, just sort of, you feel very goopy about someone. I'm not making this sound great.
No. I was gonna say permutations of affection, which is like maybe even less like a, you know, an even less attractive way to put it. But it is like there is a lot of unnameable about intimate relationships of any kind.
Right.
And I think too, there's also this you know, just that the struggle of knowability or unknowability, you know, like wanting to sort of like cross that bridge and like be like to sort of like, even to sort of like fully inhabit somebody else's perspective or even their life. Like, I think, you know, we've all gone through phases where you feel that pull and it's never doable entirely.
Yeah, it's really hard to know someone. And there's so many things to confuse love for, you know. It's like, more than anything, Pete's girl's kind of falling off a cliff and Jenny's just like kind of the first branch that she has been able to hold on to.
So did you have like a precedent for a relationship like that with that kind of age gap? Like, have you ever had a friendship in your life with somebody who was significantly older than you?
I've had friends who are older, but this relationship was one born purely out of fiction. Mostly just because I did want to make sort of a complicated relationship kind of about like two people in very different places of their lives needing things from each other, though. You know what I mean? Where Pizza Girl is not a mother yet, and this mother figure appears to her and sort of is an example of like what she could maybe become, you know? And finally, beyond that, it's just someone that seems to be a bigger mess than she is. Someone that can need her instead of her, who feels like the person that's been needing constantly for the past like 18 years of her life. And for Jenny, it's complicated too, but in some ways it's sad, but Pizza Girl could be anyone. She's also flailing.
So, okay. So how long did it take you to have that level of understanding of these two characters and their dynamic? Like, was it something that you came out of the box with, or is it something that like only towards the end of the writing of the book did you get your head fully wrapped around it?
It's a good question. I mean, I think sometimes why it's like, I get tripped up when people ask me how long it took to work on the book. Like, saying a year feels almost dishonest, and that, like, you know, I had to fail a lot of times on a bunch of different short stories and a bunch of different things I was working on to get to Pizza Girl. You know, like, it's not like it is a cute story saying I finished the novel and then just sent it out to my soon to be agent and it ended up working out. But you know, there was a lot that happened before that, like a lot of short stories I was writing that just weren't quite clicking. Although, you know, characters were forming and ideas were forming and I was getting closer to talking about the things that I wanted to talk about, you know?
Sometimes was there any kind of avoidance, like when you finally got down to the writing of Pizza Girl, were there areas of it that you might have been resisting that like when you finally like went there, you're like, okay, let's do this. And then lo and behold, this is the one that worked.
Yeah. I mean, the big crazy one I've talked about and what actually shocks a lot of people is that it was going to be pizza boy for the longest time. You know, like when I'm openly gay at this point in my life, but I wasn't for a really long time. And I just had a lot of trouble even writing female queer narrators. It just made me, I just wasn't ready to go there yet. I wasn't ready to write a perspective close to my own. And I think once I got more comfortable with that, and once I became more comfortable with myself, it just really opened up my writing. And it helped just me write voices I felt like that were a little more honest and, I don't know, more interesting, frankly.
It makes perfect sense in hindsight, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's so funny. In hindsight, you just almost want to like shake that 20-year-old kid and be like, wake up, you're great.
Yeah.
Just be you. Right. write what you want to write, you know, but I wasn't ready.
When did you, like, did your family know? Like, when did you come out? Like, it wasn't with this book, was it?
You know what? And it, this book opened up the conversation again. You know, I'm a really private person by nature, and it's been always the thing that me and my mom haven't seen eye to eye on. We're so close in so many ways, but she has had a hard time with the gay thing, and not like necessarily because of any sort of like homophobia, just sort of the worry that my life would be more difficult, or, you know, that I'd have to work harder, or, you know, just the things she was hoping that I wouldn't have to do as a American, you know? So yeah, it's the book reopened the conversation, and it's gotten just, it keeps getting better, warmer and warmer.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I was really worried about her reading the book, actually. My mom always likes when I call her after I've read something and I tell her about the book. But this is like the first book she's read in a while, and she read it really quickly in like a day. And that was, she sent me a nice email. I'm going to save that one.
That's awesome. And yeah. I feel like, I was talking to somebody on the show recently. I'm going to forget who it was, but I want to say it was a gay author who was like, we were talking about this sort of dynamic and coming out. And, the author was basically like, if you're a parent and you pay a reasonable amount of attention to your child, you've got to know.
Yeah.
That your child is gay from a pretty young age. Like, do you agree with that sentiment?
I don't know. I get it's tough because I mean, I joke with my friends about this. I was just doing such queer shit for so long. Like, I was the only girl on the baseball team, you know, and just like, I was always like doing like, you know, wearing basketball shorts. And I always had a lot of guy friends, but I don't know if maybe that's true. I don't know. I think it's basically where I hope parenthood is headed, at least now that, people are growing more open and accepting, is just that like you're having conversations with your kid about sexuality earlier, you know, where it's like me and my family never talked about it. And there was always this sort of like, I mean, level of shame with it too. One of my earliest memories is me, my dad, and this kid on my team and his dad. And we were at the sporting goods store getting like baseball mitts. And I remember we were leaving and I just made a comment. I was like, oh, the lady that helped us, it was really nice. And my friend's dad called her a dyke, you know, and I didn't even know what that meant, but it just, the way he said it, it made me feel ill, you know, and I still like that memory just gives me like a cringe, like very uncomfortable, and a lot of shame tied up in that too, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, did you send something, did you know about yourself at that point, or was it more like an intuition?
It must've, I don't know. I think I've thought a lot about that. It's like, it must have like struck something in me, whether it was just like the hateful tone or that I knew even then at like 7 or 8 that I was gay. I don't know. Either way, it stuck with me. That is one of my earliest memories.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Makes sense. I think too, like, especially as kids, but it may be any age. Mm-hmm. It's sort of amazing what we can convince ourselves of. Mm. If something's like really emotionally difficult or.
Yeah.
Like, I love to, especially I think writers maybe sometimes pride themselves on being like clear-eyed, you know, in the face of difficult emotions, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, we can take it. Like, we'll just look, we'll look into this pain and we will, you know, we'll see it for what it is. But,
right.
That doesn't mean that it can't happen to us too, you know, depending on the situation. I've had not a lot, but I have had experiences where things have, I've been so thunderstruck by difficult things or emotional pain that like I've been in a moment of denial for kind of like a, you know, it's not like a long time, but like long enough to be like, holy shit. Like, I can't believe I spent like an entire day not believing that reality was reality.
Or you're just like, sometimes you're shocked the things that still affect you or you're still holding on to. you know, like with Pizza Girl, you know, I couldn't have written it when I was 18. You know, I needed some distance from it. I needed to be able to think about it and consider it, you know.
Who did you deliver for when you were a delivery girl?
It was a mom and pop. I don't even know if it's still there. It was on like Western, and I got to look up this cross street, but yeah, downtownish area.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I delivered for Papa John's, which
did
I'm not,
you? I ordered Papa that, John's. Yeah.
Yeah. And, they still have that like really garlicky butter sauce that goes with it.
Love.
My friend Timmy and I that I grew up with, we delivered for Papa John's. This was back when we were still living in Indiana. Like
right.
I want to say like the summer after our senior year of high school.
Yeah.
And Timmy got like baked and he was delivering like this big order to this house. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I'm so hungry. And he's like, I had to eat one of the breadsticks. And it like happened to be like this family or like a kid's birthday party where they like had literally like they had done the math and like each kid was going to get two breadsticks or something. They called the store.
Brutal.
Yeah. So he got like caught like eating somebody's breadstick.
Wow. Because I was going to say, I was like, I definitely had coworkers that would pull stuff like that and they actually never got in trouble. Wow. Your friend got a bad deal there.
Like who are the people who count the breadsticks?
Yeah, God.
God, Nazis. But no, I did that. And then I did, what was it? It was Mountain Mike's. That was a mom and pop in Boulder. And then I did my last stint was, this place called Mad Mushroom. So I did
Mad Mushroom. I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And you want to know something crazy now? It's like all coming back to me. There was this guy, and I'm going to forget his name because this is like my weakness. I never remember names, but I can see his face.
Yeah.
And I want to say he was like a first generation American from like the Czech Republic.
Okay.
And, or like he was like Slavic, you know, mm-hmm. like there's something sort of tough about him. He wasn't a big guy, but like he had like that.
Basically, you don't want to fuck with him, that kind of energy.
That kind of thing. Like a nice guy, but like there was nothing jokey about him.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? He was not like, and he was the fastest driver at the store by a long shot. Like he could do more runs in a night than like any other driver at the store. And I got to the point where I was like, dude, this guy is like, he's lapping the field. Like how does he, because you begin as you drive a certain territory. And I think you could probably speak to this as well. Like you begin to develop a certain pride in your mastery of the map.
Yes. How quickly, you know, and like how you know, this street or this side street.
Right. And so that's what I think he was genius at, is that he was a fast driver and he was good, you know, at driving fast, but he knew every alley, he knew every, you know, every sort of hustle in terms of like beating traffic patterns. And I would try on certain nights, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to see if I can keep up with this guy. And I just couldn't do it. there again, my competitive fire just wasn't burning hot enough.
Yeah, wasn't burning hot enough. No, I did a lot of night shifts, so I was never too quick. And this or that, but I also didn't have to be. So that was probably good. Because again, it sounds like we both like to enjoy a little bit of weed before we went on our shifts.
It was the best. And just listening to music. Oh, I'm so old. I was listening to like cassette tapes.
Funny enough, I had my car I drove. It's not the same car as the one in the book, but it was an 02 Jeep Liberty. And it had a tape deck. And
I
so.
I had a Jeep Cherokee.
One of those, shit.
I had one of those like boxy, like the boxy red. That's what I had. Yeah. And that was my, and I would have my dog.
Your
I
dog?
Had my dog. Yeah. I had my border collie Merlin would, I mean, this was very Boulder, but he would ride with me on all my shifts.
That's an awesome image. Also, God, what did people say when they saw a dog in your car?
It was Boulder. It was like, okay. And like the pizzas were inside the Hot Pocket. They were inside you know, they were in boxes and they were in like Hot Pocket. It's like my dog was like sitting on their pizza.
Yes.
But you know, he didn't like, it was better to have him in the car than to have him stay home alone.
I would have taken a dog if I could have too. No, but there is it's so funny. After the day my book came out, I knew that the New York Times was going to review it. But I had like no idea what they were going to say, obviously. And I don't sleep a lot in general anyway, but my body just knew. I like woke with a start at like 3 a.m. and my heart was beating and I was like, oh shit. And then I looked at my phone and I looked up the New York Times and the review was really glowing and really lovely. And I was just like, wow. And I just sort of laid there for a sec and I don't know what it was. I got into my car and I just sort of went on a drive and I don't know. It felt almost like just like the perfect thing to do. the day.
And then I realized I went into my kitchen and realized that I had left a glass of whiskey out on the table and there was a dead fly in it.
Yeah, two dead flies this time. I listened to the new Run the Jewels album and I drove down the 110 freeway and then back up the entire way. So I emptied out in San Pedro, then I went back to Pasadena, and then I went back to my apartment. It was a nice drive.
What time was this?
Oh, this was like 4 a.m.
Damn. So no traffic.
No,
it was good.
Perfect. I felt like I had to remind myself. I was like, don't get too comfortable. It would be very tragic if you got into a car accident on the day your book came out.
Just like you're taking your victory lap and By the way, we just kind of sounded, you remember that skit, The Californians from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, God. Yeah, I sounded so LA there.
I just watched that actually with my daughter last night. She's like 9 years old and she's obsessed with Kristen Wiig.
Oh, great idol to have.
That's what my wife and I were like, okay. And we didn't push that on her. She just gravitated. So she's really into Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph. So we feel like we're doing something right.
Wow.
It's like the best I've felt about my parenting, maybe ever.
Well, if you want to keep being a good parent, don't let her read Pizza Girl until she graduates high school or something. And then that'll be
sure.
Good.
I want her to. I want my daughter to be reading beyond her grade level.
Okay, maybe a mature 15, 16. Then,
Can sometimes overdo that, where I'm like, I think she's ready for Apocalypse Now. It's like.
Yeah, I know. I think it's going to be tough for me if I have kids too, because I feel like I just got into stuff a little, perhaps too early. Like Grand Theft Auto, for example. That was my favorite game when I was 9 years old, which is horrifying.
That's
healthy.
It turned out okay. Well, and this thing too about you not being able to sleep. You're telling me you're drinking Monster Energy drinks. No wonder you can't sleep.
Yeah, maybe that's a part of it. I need to flush out my bloodstream with just some good old water. Maybe I need to become a vegan like you are.
I think it's good to run your, burn clean, burn clean fuel.
Yeah.
But I say that, exactly. And I'm also, I drink a lot of caffeine. I'm not, and I drink alcohol pretty much every day. I have a glass of wine.
I do like a good glass of red.
Well, it's just I don't know. I can get really austere in my thinking sometimes where I'm like, why do I need that glass? What's up? But it's never more than one glass usually. Unless I'm out to dinner, which I never am. And
especially these days.
Yeah, especially these days. So I'm not a big drinker, but I do enjoy, I think of my grandmother, my mom's mom, and she was she was very tiny. When she died, she weighed 90 pounds. She's one of these little petite, 5 foot tall people. And, She had 9 children and smoked unfiltered cigarettes through half of the pregnancies. They're all healthy as horses, knock on wood.
Yeah.
She had 9 babies, but then I want to say at some point she was probably in her mid 30s, or the doctor was just look, if you keep doing this, you're going to have emphysema.
Oh, shit.
And so she quit. I could be botching this story. But then she quit, and then she was so stressed from having all these babies and trying to be a parent all the time, she got ulcers and then had to have I want to say 3/4 of her stomach removed.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So she had this teeny tiny stomach, which is part of the reason why she was so little.
Yeah.
But I remember going down to visit, cause she lived in the small town, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And she would have, they had these little baby beers. They're little teeny tiny cute.
Baby beers?
Just you would, they're adorable. The little Miller Lights.
Oh, or a Coronita.
Yeah, it's just a tiny little baby beer. And and she had those in her fridge, a bunch of them in there's a fridge in the laundry room, I remember. And you'd always be Gammy wants her, her beer. And I would go get her a beer. And she had one of those every night with dinner. And she lived to be into her 90s. So.
That's
my theory of the case. I think having one drink a day as an adult is a healthy way to approach life.
Hell yeah. But why not?
I'm not, I guess maybe I should get into baby beers. That's kind of.
Yeah. I'm going to look for that next time I'm at the store. I have a little dirt patch in front of my apartment. So I've been trying to just have relaxing routines for myself. So I might have a glass of wine or a beer and I'll read whatever book I'm reading out there in my little camping chair. Since I don't have an actual yard.
Where do you live? Do you mind saying what part of town you live in?
Oh, yeah. I'm at the edge of Chinatown.
Oh, that's right. You said near Echo Park.
Yes. Yeah. So right before it begins, basically.
So how, where do you stand on masks? I'm going to just come out first so I don't set, I don't want to set you up to fail in case you're one of these monsters walking around without a mask on, but like,
I am not.
Okay. Yeah. I go out and I am like going on my hikes and I am just shooting daggers at these people.
Unbelievable, man. It's, luckily my neighborhood is actually really low key and quiet and everyone's pretty good on masks, but here and there you'll just see, like, I don't know. It annoys me more when there's people who live across the street from me. It looks like they've been throwing parties, you know, and it just makes me so mad.
I just don't get it. I think, though, I was joking with a friend of mine this morning. I was sort of like, I was texting and I was like, you know what? Like, the upside of the masks or the no masks is that it sort of lets you know very easily who the selfish, like, asshole morons are.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, oh, okay, well, there you go. You're just going to walk.
There you have
you're
it.
You're just going to walk into the grocery store and get people sick. You don't give a shit.
Yeah. Clearly. God, I've been seeing some wild videos.
I think those people are actors. That's what I think.
They have to be. I mean, like, the one story I read, this woman wasn't even trying to shop. She was just getting up in people's faces, which, you know, is even sicker somehow. I was like, wow, you really came just to fuck with people.
See, I'm so paranoid. I think that that's propaganda that's either financed by... Mm-hmm. Foreign influences or by bad like subterranean actors who want to try to foment division among Americans and to like politicize masks, which is
right.
That's what pisses me off too about it, is that it's just such a stupid thing to politicize.
No, I know. I don't. I'm just like, it's safety. I don't know how this is an issue, how we're having an argument about this.
Right. Exactly. But we found a way, you know, people found a way to get like up in arms about it. And I think too, like it's like the pressures brought to bear by this moment upon people, whether it's, you know, it's always a combination of things. It's going to be like financial pressure, which is very real for a lot of people. But also just like the pressure of having to be socially isolated, the pressure of having your routines disrupted, and not just like your healthy routine, like, oh my God, I can't go to like my, you know, Zumba class or whatever it is. But like the routines that we use traditionally to distract ourselves from our suffering.
Right.
You're like, oh, wait, I can't go do X, Y, and Z, which is how I used to totally like distract myself, you know, and keep my mind off of things. Like, suddenly these things get ripped away. And I think when people's defenses are down in that way, it has yielded some interesting behaviors.
Yeah. Good way to put it.
But I think that on the positive side, pizza delivery businesses have to be killing it during.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the few things. I've mostly been cooking, but I have ordered pizza several times. I've also, at this point, though, can't eat any more pizza. After my book came out, my friends are so sweet. They just sent me too much pizza. I'm ill and I'm overweight.
Really? I guess it makes sense that people would send you pizza.
Yeah. It was like, you know, since like we can't really obviously celebrate in person, people wanted to do something nice for me, which is very sweet.
What about tipping? Like, you've got to be a pretty good tipper for the pizza delivery people.
You have to. I, you know, of course I have a soft spot with it too. You know, it's funny, when I was delivering, I was actually very understanding when people couldn't tip, but it did make the people who are good tippers feel that much sweeter, you know.
I think that the general theory for me is that if you've ever worked for tips, you're a good tipper.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes people just don't have any money and they're just like,
that's why I was always really like tried to be understanding if someone gave me a shitty tip, you know.
I try. I mean, if somebody's like if it's like, oh, they've got like, you know, $6 $1 bills that are like, they look like they've been through the laundry, and then the rest they give you in change and they have a coupon, like, fine. Okay. Like,
yeah.
But the people who are just like cheap, like, there's nothing worse to me.
An asshole.
Yeah, people who don't tip well drive me absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, especially when you know that they just don't view a serving job as something that deserves a much reward, you know.
Yeah, I had a friend who was like, had like a very strong opinion in that direction, and I was just like, have you ever been in a situation where like you're at a table with some friends and you all are like splitting the tab, and then like you're like watching to see what the tip is going to be, and then you're like, oh my God, that person just like shorted the tip, and so like everybody gets up, and then you sneak back to the table and like throw more money on there just so you're, you know. I've done that a few times.
Yeah, I've done that for sure.
What are you working on now? You got another book in the works, or are you going to do that basketball book, or?
I'm trying to. I have two things actually. I'm working on this basketball book. It's this group of girls in the Midwest that think their team is winning because they're all virgins. So they kind of make a pact to not lose their virginity until they win a state title.
Whoa.
So I think that can be a lot of fun. Yeah. But somehow I feel like I haven't been working on that lately. And it might be just because I'm burnt out writing about high school age people, you know? So I've been working more on my stoner tragedy, which is people closer to my age, like late 20s, early 30s.
What can you elaborate at all on stoner tragedy?
Yeah, I love stoner comedies, but what always struck me and still strikes me about them is how easily they could be really sad. Like if you think about like Pineapple Express, the main character, Seth Rogen's character, Dale Denton, I mean, a sad name in itself. He's like a process server, you know, he's dating a girl who's like in high school. It's kind of yikes, you know, and in Harold and Kumar, like there's like a lot of emotion about like Harold feeling really conflicted about his heritage and the way he's viewed, his Asianness is viewed, his masculinity, and Kumar is smart enough to be a doctor, but, you know, is a total slacker. I don't know. There's just so much rich material there. And I was like, what would it be like if I just went pure literary, pure sadness? You know, of course, I say sadness. I definitely still is actually maybe it's one of the funniest things I've allowed myself to do, but it is a tragedy ultimately.
Is there a middle-aged podcaster in the book?
I will write him in. Lad Bristy.
Yeah, just put me in for a cameo.
Yeah, exactly.
You can wedge me in there.
I'll find a way.
And I let you go, this is something that just came to mind as you were talking about being sick of writing high school people.
Yeah.
is the interesting way in which you got into the voice of Pizza Girl, which I think is worth listeners hearing about, because
yeah.
I think even, you know, it's weird how we get removed from our experiences. Like I'm 44. I couldn't tell you a damn thing about high school. I know some people have like this perfect recall and they can remember.
I'm not one of those people.
I don't remember anybody. I don't remember what happened. I don't care, you know? And
sometimes I think that's a coping mechanism too. I'm like, I am a present person.
Right.
I can't dwell too much, you know?
I can't, but I also just don't have the recall.
Yeah.
And I think too, like my general attitude, I mean, it's not like it's a total blank. Like I can remember, I remember what I remember. And like my theory is that, I feel like I have a lot of theories today, but I feel like...
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah, I just feel like whatever sticks is what's supposed to stick.
Mm, yeah.
You know?
I think Lil Wayne, to quote a great poet, has this song, 10,000 Bars, and it's like 40 minutes, and he just literally rapped everything he ever wrote down, and then he never wrote down a word again. That's true. Look that up. Lil Wayne, 10,000 Bars. I thought it was so badass when I heard about it when I was in high school.
Damn.
And yeah, and he ever since has just sort of kind of just gone with the flow, you know. Of course, it's like it's more technical than that, but he doesn't really try to write his lyrics down anymore.
That's what Jay-Z does too.
Yeah.
They just, it's like from memory.
Yeah, very
or,
cool.
Or they just make it up or whatever. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like not being precious, I think is kind of the idea. You know,
but that, no, that's like, this is it. We're coming full circle. It's the not giving a fuck. It's giving less of a fuck as a, not as a way of like not caring about the work, but like uncorking your creativity and like taking some of the neurosis out of it, you know?
Totally.
So how did you get into the voice of Pizza Girl? Tell that story. Cause I think it's a useful, like considering how hard it is to like remember even when you're only just a few years removed from those times and like wanting it to be authentic, you know, making the prose work in a way that feels true to the age of the character.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't actively thinking, like I didn't even at that point really know exactly what the vibe of Pizza Girl would be, other than I knew I wanted to write it. And then I was dating this girl who saw that I had over 50,000 unread emails, and she was like, "Are you a sociopath?" And I'm like, "No, I'm normal, I swear." And so I just like went to kind of like delete those emails. I was like, "All right, maybe she's right. Maybe I should clean out this inbox." And I got all the way back to like 09, 2010, and kind of stumbled upon all the emails me and like the first like love of my life sent each other, you know? And I just was like really moved. It was like sad, not so much because I missed this person. Like it had been so long at that point. I don't even know who that girl is anymore. It was more just, I was like, I didn't know who that version of me was anymore.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I read it and I was just so blown away by, like, kind of like what we were talking about earlier, like the boldness that I had, the tenderness, and I don't know, I felt a lot of love for that version of me, and it was kind of then where I was like, I think this is sort of the voice I try to emulate, you know, like this is sort of like, and not exactly the prose, but the like energy of it and just the bare nakedness of it.
I get that. That's like, yeah. That's where I think growing up in a completely digital environment has its benefits, is that
yes.
The email record is there unless you've scrubbed it.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. You know, but at least email's not like living on the internet, you know, in public.
Yeah. Yeah, thank God I'm not a blogger. I was never a blogger.
Yeah, no, that's not I guess like there might be some of my blogs on like the Wayback Machine or something, but you know, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, I have so enjoyed talking to you. Like I said,
Me too, Brad.
I feel like I'm like drunk on sleep deprivation, but it's been a real joy to chat with you and to catch you as this book makes its way out into the world. You're such a young writer to be this good and to be having this success. Oh, that's very exciting for you. And I wish you luck on the basketball book and on the Stoner Tragedy. Does the Stoner Tragedy have a title?
Yes, it does. I'm going to keep it to myself at this point, but there will be a Brad Listy appearance in it, everyone. So keep your eyes open for that.
I better look good. That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Gene, it's a pleasure and best of luck to you.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, there you go. That is Gene Keong Frazier. Her debut novel is called Pizza Girl. It is available from Doubleday. You can find her online at GoGeneFrazierGo.com. You can follow her on Twitter at GoGeneFrazierGo. Again, the novel is Pizza Girl, the official July pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. It's out there now from Doubleday. Go get your copy right now. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode of this show is made available for free. More than 650 episodes and counting. It's all free. It's a listener-supported show. If you like the show, support the show at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Don't forget, too, you can get Other People gear. T-shirts, sweatshirts, tank tops, for real. They're really soft and they look cool. If you want an Other People t-shirt or some such, just go to otherppl.com and there's a little thingamajig in the left sidebar. You'll see it. Click on it. Get yourself some apparel. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com, letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. The Other People podcast has its own app, The Other People with Brad Listy app. It's available where apps are available. Go get the app. The app is free. It's all free. So coming up next time on The Other People Show, I have Maggie Downs on the program. What an absolutely fun person she is. Just wonderful to talk with. I'm excited to share that conversation with you coming up next on The Other People program. So I hope that you are doing well out there. I should mention, too, happy birthday to my boy River, my son. He just turned 5 yesterday. Should have had him on the show. I forgot. But he's napping right now. He's had a big day. There's all sorts of like plastic toys and shit all over my house. Where does the time go? We just get sucked into the void, man.